From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Last hour of the program tonight, Joshua P. Warren's paranormal moment as he goes into other dimensions. Hey, there's a story breaking tonight on WorldNet Daily. I'm not going to say much about it, but it's there for you if you want to go read it when you get a moment. I wanted you to be one of the first to see it. Now, here's one of those I can't believe it stories. A comprehensive immigration bill coming together in the Senate could include a requirement that all American workers, you, obtain a national biometric identification card. My. Under the proposal, all legal U.S. workers, including citizens and immigrants, would get an ID card with information such as fingerprints embedded into it. The effort is being spearheaded by Senators Chuck Schumer of Democrat out of New York and Lindsey Graham, Republican out of South Carolina. They and their supporters say requiring companies to hire only people with worker ID cards would keep illegal immigrants from taking American jobs. Catherine Albrecht has been monitoring stories like this for years. Catherine, this sounds like a little privacy invasion.
Hey, George, I got to tell you, this was one of the worst stories to come down the pike in a long time. Lots of people losing sleep last night over the idea that we would get a national ID card through the back door, actually, in the name of fighting illegal immigration, causing every American to have a biometric national ID card that they're going to have in order to earn a living, in order to put food on their table and pay their bills and pay their mortgage and keep the lights on, which is what having a job is all about. We're going to have to sign up for this mandatory, essentially biometric national ID. There's no other way to refer to this thing. It starts off, of course, with an employment situation, just like back in the 1930s when they introduced the Social Security number. They said, don't worry, this is only for your retirement. We're just going to take 1% of your income. We're going to put it aside. We'll never use it for identification purposes. And, you know, we had all these promises. If they get this thing in, this is going to be the nose of the camel in the tent. In fact, it's going to be half the camel in the tent here. It's going to expand. You're going to need to have it to vote. You're going to need to have it, I believe, down the road eventually to even shop at a grocery store.
Jeez, this is frightening. Now, any truth to the rumors that the numbers will start with 3 6s?
Not yet. I haven't seen that one yet.
Tongue in cheek.
But let me tell you, George, on the same, the reason I lost some sleep last night is this story came out as a headline last night, right alongside the story that Great Britain is imposing national mandatory microchipping on all of the dogs in the country. And the reason that's important is these two things come together. When you start talking national ID cards, you can look to China, which just issued 1 billion national ID cards with RFID microchips encoded in them. So in China, everything you want to do, you want to get some transportation, you want to go on the subway, you've got to scan your national ID card to do pretty much
and anything. And they'll know where they are every second of the day, Catherine.
That's the deal. And, you know, the same technology that goes in those Chinese national ID cards, it is the same RFID technology with just a few minor changes versus what you can put in somebody's right hand with a microchip implant. So we're seeing mandatory chipping, we're seeing mandatory ID cards, and it's not going to be long before those two are going to converge in this country.
Well, hold on, Catherine. It's going to be one of those rides. Catherine's website on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Authorities in Pennsylvania say a gas station patron died. Listen to this. He's filling up his car when static electricity ignited a fire as he filled up his tank. Authorities say the 19-year-old of central Pennsylvania died at a gas station in Camp Hill. A gas station equipment expert says the only other fatality from static-generated fire was in Oklahoma more than a decade ago. My gosh, you're on your way home, you're filling up your tank, and you die. The magnitude 8.8 earthquake that rocked the west coast of Chile last month was violent enough to move the city of Concepcion at least 10 feet to the west, 10 feet, and the capital, Santiago, about 11 inches to the west-southwest, according to researchers. Our geologist Jim Berklin on the line with us here. Jim, this is huge to move a city 10 feet.
Well, with an 8.8 quake, that's the kind of thing you can expect. That when Alaska's big quake hit in 64, it was a 47-foot differential movement between the ocean and the continent. 47 feet, that's the largest I've heard about. And of course, 1906 San Francisco, it went sideways 21 feet. So those numbers are not frightening, just to have to deal with when you get a great earthquake.
And what happened deep into the ocean? How much tectonic plate movement do you think we had then, Jim?
Well, you just have to do the geometry on it. The slope of the subduction zone was probably 40 degrees, inclined underneath Chile, and the Pacific plate was pushing underneath, and it moves intermittently, and the only thing that's holding it in place is friction. And if you can overcome that friction, as it does periodically, it slips.
That's where
you get these massive movements. And, you know, that was a biggie. What bothers me more than hearing about that is that they're trying to lower the death toll in the Chile earthquake, saying that they're only going to count the ones that they have identified.
Unbelievable. All right, Jim, thank you so much for monitoring everything. Great geologist. Predicted the major earthquake in 1989 during the World Series up there in the Oakland Bay area. He was correct. Then he got fired from his California government geology job because he made a prediction. Do you like to fish? I used to a lot, but not anymore. I don't have the time to do it. I should, but it was relaxing and fun. Well, now the Obama administration will accept no more public input for a federal strategy that could prohibit U.S. citizens from fishing the nation's oceans, coastal areas, Great Lakes, and even inland waters. This announcement comes at a time when the situation supposedly still is fluid, and the Interagency Ocean Policy Task Force, they have task forces for everything now, still hasn't issued its final report on zoning uses of these waters. Now, LifeLock, it's a company that sponsors many shows around the country, including ours, will spend $12 million settling claims that it engaged in deceptive advertising and failed to protect customers' personal information. The Federal Trade Commission and 35 state attorney generals announced that LifeLock is changing its business model to address allegations of unfair and deceptive business practices. Consumers who signed up with the service as early as 2005, about a million customers in all, will be eligible for refunds. The firm remains in business and has agreed to change its advertising practices. The head of the Federal Trade Commission said its services do provide some protection against identity theft, but not the level it repeatedly promised consumers in its well-known advertising campaigns. As Richard Hoagland has talked about on our program, the mystery of Phobos, the moon of Mars, one of them, something is wrong with this moon. The Martian moon looks like a solid, but it is not as dense as a rocky solid should be. Researchers are baffled. Some think perhaps it's riddled with vast caverns. Others say it's just a rubble pile. Others say it's artificial. To solve the mystery, Europe's Mars Express spacecraft is making a series of close flybys this month. High-res photos could be available as early as Wednesday. We'll have webmaster Lex check those out for you and put them on coasttocoastam.com. And a story in our hot news, a 101-year-old woman has grown a horn on her head and now fears she's growing another one, almost like the devil. The Chinese woman said, started off small, like a little lump. Now it's 6 centimeters long, and the small lump has now appeared on the other side of her forehead. Her youngest son said, started off as a patch of thick, rough skin. Very bizarre picture down there at coasttocoastam.com. The U.S. soft drinks industry, by the way, says it has dramatically cut the number of high-calorie soft drinks sold in U.S. schools as part of a drive to tackle obesity. The American Beverage Association said shipments of full-calorie drinks to schools were down 95%. Nearly 1 in 3 children and teenagers in the U.S. are overweight or obese, and health experts say sugary drinks are part of the problem. There is an epidemic out there of untreated thyroid disease, and it could be a factor in the rise of cancer, heart disease. It might affect you right now, and you don't even know it. In a moment, Dr. Mark Starr joins us as we talk about hypothyroidism on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Mark Starr is a board certified by the American Board of Pain Medicine and the Arizona State Board of Homeopathic Medical Examiners. In 2005, he published the widely acclaimed Hypothyroidism Type 2, The Epidemic. Dr. Starr's progressive approach to alternative medicine offers cutting-edge therapies designed to accelerate the healing of hypothyroidism, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and other issues like arthritis, sprains, strains, and fractures. He came to our program because of the work of Dr. John Apsley, who will be joining us next hour. Dr. Mark Starr here on Coast to Coast. Mark, how are you, Doc?
Very well, thanks. Glad to be on your show.
Good to have you here, indeed. You know, I did not realize how important the thyroid was until I read your book. You know, we take this organ for granted, don't we?
Yes. Unfortunately, it's not widely publicized, and it's not taught. There's not a whole lot of information taught in medical schools or training programs anymore besides treating blood tests. And it affects every cell in the body. Some of the more common symptoms are fatigue and weakness, cold intolerance, joint and muscle pain, depression, obesity, headaches, heart disease, high blood pressure. For the first half of the 20th century, if you had high cholesterol, that meant you were low thyroid, menstrual problems, on and on and on. And Dr. Apsley talked about how you're more apt to have cancer develop when you're low thyroid as well. So there's everything from birth defects to Alzheimer's and in between. So from birth to the grave, it can affect every aspect of your life.
Let's talk about this organ called the thyroid. Exactly where is it?
It's on the front of the throat. It wraps around the trachea, and it's called the master gland in our body. None of the other hormone-producing tissues can function very well if the thyroid is not functioning properly. And it controls every aspect of our metabolism. It's called the basal metabolism. So they used to test it by putting a tube in your mouth and seeing how much oxygen you inhaled and carbon dioxide you exhaled. And they had a large number of people that they tested, and they, according to your age, height, weight, and sex, they could tell if your metabolism was normal because it controls the speed and efficiency at which each of our trillions of cells operate. And if you were low metabolism and had some of the symptoms in the old days, you would receive treatment.
And it's a small organ, right?
It's very small. A teaspoon of this stuff is what powers you for a whole year.
Oh, my. Okay. Now, what got you, Dr. Starr, interested in investigating the thyroid and hypothyroidism?
I was a medical doctor. I always wanted to be a medical doctor. But I had a bad motorcycle accident when I was 20, the day summer school got out. And I like to say I took my 20s off because I had a significant injury and was in the hospital a week. And then an important part of my story was I knocked out a front tooth in that motorcycle accident. And after a week in the hospital, I went straight to the dentist's office. And they did a root canal, and I found out sometime later, many decades, that they'd filled my root canal with mercury amalgam.
Ugh.
And by the time I went back to school to get my MD degree, I was in almost 30, and I didn't finish med school till I was 37. And I did 4 years of post-med school training at the University of Missouri. And by the time I was 40, I was cold. I was becoming more fatigued. My concentration was going. I had joint muscle pain, a number of different symptoms, dry skin. And my older brother and my mother were already taking the synthetic thyroid that the doctors are taught to prescribe. And I was complaining to my colleagues that I was low thyroid. But no one would treat me because my blood tests were normal. And I was a physical medicine and rehab doctor. And I didn't know enough to treat myself. They told me I was working too hard. And that's why I had all of my symptoms. Well, fortunately, I saw a wonderful doctor from the Bronx Veterans Hospital, the chairman of the PM&R, the Physical Medicine and Rehab Department lecture in my last year of formal training in 1993, and I suspected that my muscle pain, as well as a number of my patients, were due to, or my pain and so many of my patients' pain was probably due to the muscle pain, which we were taught very little about, and I was very fortunate to go study with him at the Bronx Veterans Hospital, and his teacher was 90 when I went to study with him. His name was Hans Krauss.
90 years old, teacher?
90 years old, still working 2 days a week at the New York Hospital, Lenox Hill, the Lenox Hill Pain Center, New York, the Lenox Hill Hospital. And he had been an orthopedic surgeon trained in Vienna and immigrated to the United States in 1937, believe it or not. And he was teaching in 1996. Anyway, that was his last student and one of his last patients. But he knew that people who had diffuse muscle tenderness and pain, like I did, often had metabolic problems. He had worked very closely with two endocrinologists for the last 30 years of his career and his life. And he sent me to one of the endocrinologists. He had studied with these two guys. He was President Kennedy's last pain specialist, because he'd been working with Kennedy's endocrinologist named Gene Cohen. And Dr. Cohen insisted Dr. Krause, Hans Krause was his name, come treat President Kennedy after he'd had three failed back surgeries and he was becoming more and more crippled. And Krause was able to treat his muscles and basically cure President Kennedy's back pain. And he had President Eisenhower begin the President's Council on Physical Fitness. He was the Olympic ski doctor for decades. His nickname was the Maestro of Muscle.
He knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing, and he sent me, when I got to meet Dr. Krause, he sent me right to the endocrinologist who put me on thyroid my first visit. And I started getting much better, and I asked Dr. Sonkin, was his name, Larry Sonkin. He was an MD, PhD at the New York Hospital Cornell Endocrinology Clinic. I asked Dr. Sonkin why some of the research he had done wasn't in the endocrinology literature and the textbooks. And he said the clinic, the New York Hospital Cornell Endocrinology Clinic, was where they developed the pap smear. It was the number one endocrinology clinic in the world back in the 30s and 40s when he began his career. And he said because he sat in the ivory tower with the mavens and his research didn't jive with what the powers that be, the chairman of the department and so on, dictated to be true, so it wasn't published anywhere. So anyway, I started getting well right away on my thyroid, and after 2 years of study in New York, I went back to Missouri and started my own pain clinic. It took about 2 years for me to realize that most of my patients had the same thing I did, which was low thyroid.
Now, whereabouts in Missouri were you at the time?
I graduated from the University of Missouri in Columbia.
Good school.
My parents and my brother were living there, nieces and so on. And that's where I went back to practice, and that's where I stayed for my first 5 years. But after a couple of years, you know, I spent enough time with my patients treating their muscles, and I was doing my own physical therapy and so on. I realized that they all had low thyroid, or at least a lot of them. And Dr. Sonkin treated numerous pain patients with just hormones.
Mark, of let's say 10 people walking around, how many do you think might have problems with their thyroids?
Well, I like to quote, my book is full of the best research. Anyway, I made it my business to find out how come doctors became so misled and things went haywire with the thyroid. And so I put the best research I could find, and the first description of low thyroid was in the late 1800s. And the best doctor that ever did research in America was named Broda Barnes, and he was a PhD physiologist of low thyroid, and then he studied people and animal research and autopsies for 50 years before he died in his 80s in the 1980s. And he published a book called Hypothyroidism, the Unexpected Illness, in 1976. And in that book, he said 40% of all Americans had the problem.
Jeez.
And in 10 more years, 50% of us would have it.
That's you're right. It is an epidemic, isn't it?
No, it's severe. And unfortunately, it's not being diagnosed or treated properly.
Okay, we'll get into some of the symptoms in a moment, Mark, and also how you treat this. And then later on tonight, we'll talk about a simple test that people can do on their own with the help of a thermometer, and we'll let you explain that as well. Just, it's dramatic. What is government, in terms of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, what are they doing about this? Anything?
No, unfortunately, as I say in my latest print of my book, which is now available, none of the research in my book is taught in medical schools anymore. It's not taught in any formal medical program. And for over 40 years, the doctors have just been taught to treat the thyroid blood tests. And as per the research in my book, the blood tests are missing the majority of people, the vast majority of people with the illness, number one. And number two, the treatment, which is also based on blood tests using a synthetic hormone, is inadequate as well. So the people aren't being diagnosed or treated properly, and it's a total disaster.
We'll be back with you in just a moment. You know, I bought your book right after Dr. John was on the show. I bought your book on Amazon.com for myself. And then 2 days later, my producer sent me another copy and said, hey, do you want him on the show? And I went, absolutely. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it sure is. With our special guest tonight, Dr. Mark Starr, his book, Hypothyroidism Type 2, The Epidemic. And we'll be back with Dr. Mark Starr in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. A lot of people, Dr. Mark Starr, they're at home, they're taking notes. What are some of the symptoms of hypothyroidism?
Number one is fatigue and weakness. Number two is cold intolerance. Joint and muscle pain are quite common. If you used to have arthritis around the turn of the last century, 1900s, that meant you needed thyroid. And depression, obesity, dry skin that's puffy, muscle cramps, headaches, constipation, long-term problems, high blood pressure, heart attacks, heart disease.
Almost everything.
Just about. It controls everything.
Now, if you have hypothyroidism, does that mean you have cancer of the thyroid or not?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, as a matter of fact, my book is called Type 2 Hypothyroidism because it's quite similar to type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is when the pancreas fails to produce insulin and you die relatively quickly if you don't get any insulin.
Right.
And type 2 diabetics have plenty of insulin in their bloodstream. Some even have elevated amounts of insulin, but it's not able to be utilized properly by the cells.
And you can check type 2 by exercise, losing weight, and watching what you eat, can't you?
Yes, and a large number of patients, you can resolve it by taking those measures. My teacher, Dr. Sonkin, referred to the type 2 hypothyroidism as peripheral resistance syndrome. But my editor, I have a wonderful editor who's an oral surgeon, Dr. Tom Bach, he had the same problem I did, which was he went to the doctor 6 or 8 times trying to get some thyroid because he knew all the symptoms, and he had all the symptoms, but he wasn't able to receive treatment either. So when I met him many years back, he latched on to my book. He'd been an editor for the Emory newspaper, where he went to Scott College. Anyway, let's see, where was I?
Well, we were talking about hypothyroidism type 2.
Right, so he decided to call...
Aren't you glad I take notes?
Well, I certainly am, I'm sorry.
Because my memory is not very good, let me tell you.
Most of my anxiety is past with the initial part, but anyway, so it was a great idea, his idea, to call it type 2, because it's quite similar to type 2 diabetes, in which... it's a cellular problem. There is a whole chapter in my book on environmental toxins, about all the environmental toxins, and they're numerous, that interfere with thyroid and cause type 2. Also, there's inherited genetic defects. There are things like fluorine. There's also something in the body. Every cell has hundreds or thousands of something called mitochondria, which are responsible for 90% of the energy production in our body. And all the mitochondria are inherited from the mother. And like I said, they're responsible for 90% of the energy production. And the most thing that I'm most proud about was having read all the research on thyroid back into the 1800s. I realized once I heard a lecture about Alzheimer's, the lady was talking about mitochondria and Alzheimer's, and everything she said was what I'd been reading about thyroid. So I started reading about these mitochondria, and there are whole research departments and journals devoted to the study of mitochondria these days because they cause everything from Alzheimer's to heart disease and you name it. And that's type 2 hypothyroidism. So there are a whole host of things that cause type 2, but the most important thing is that it does not show up on the blood tests. So that's type 1, just like type 1 diabetics don't produce insulin. Mm-hmm. Well, type 1 hypothyroidism, you do not produce thyroid hormones, and that's what they pick up on their blood tests. But just like 90% of diabetics have type 2, it's my opinion that 90% of people with hypothyroidism have type 2 as well. So they're missing 90% of the people with hypothyroidism with their blood tests.
I was looking at some of the pictures in your book. People before treatment, I mean, their faces are puffy, their joints are puffy. It's dramatic after they're treated.
Yes, and believe it or not, the last textbook that was published that had before and after treatment pictures was in 1957. Dr. Lisser was president of the American Endocrine Society, and his colleague, Dr. Escamilla, and he both were at the University of California, San Francisco, their entire careers. And this was a wonderful textbook that I just happened upon doing all of my research. And they have a whole host of before and after treatment pictures, most of which are in my book. And they were the last doctors to treat patients in basal metabolism and using basal temperature and using the old-fashioned thyroid that's worked quite well for over 100 years. And they resolved these patients' hypothyroidism quite dramatically. And unfortunately, there haven't been any before and after treatment pictures for the last 50-plus years.
Jeez. We're getting a lot of responses from folks who are firing away on their computer, sending us instant messages. We call it Fast Blast here. We're going to cover a lot of ground tonight with Dr. Mark Starr, so most of your questions we will get to, so just slow down. Hold on. A lot of people not only are affected by this, but they're beginning to hear about this for the first time.
Yeah.
That's dramatic all by itself, Mark.
Yes, I'm sorry. It's not my fault.
Well, I'm going to blame you for it. No, you know, I'm glad that Dr. John Apsley mentioned you, and here you are, you know, and,
yeah.
You know, if 4 out of 10 people might have this problem, that's a lot of people listening to this program.
Yes, it is. And I had I read back the research back before they had a cure. The first comprehensive report on hypothyroidism was in 1888. There was a 300-page report by the Clinical Society of London on the subject of myxedema. And the medical term for hypothyroidism is myxedema. Myx means mucin, which is a normal constituent of all of our connective tissues. It holds our connective tissues together, and it holds onto water like glue. And edema means swelling. And a quote that I took from that, which came in on a library loan, by the way, the original 1888 report was in a rubber band. And the quote that I put in my book was, "The general uniformity of the more prominent symptoms is indeed remarkable, allowing ready recognition of the malady in any freshly encountered case by an observer who has seen one well-pronounced case." So in other words, in 1888, these doctors who did the initial research on low thyroid said, once you've seen one, you've seen them all. And that's the puffiness that's in the pictures that resolves with the old-fashioned desiccated thyroid.
Now, how can hypothyroidism cause heart disease? How can it do that?
Well, there are two hallmarks. Back in 1891, they were taking out thyroid glands and starting to use the old-fashioned thyroid, basically animal glandular thyroid extracts to cure these animals they were studying. The first cure of a person was in 1891. But there are two hallmarks of low thyroid. One is accelerated hardening of the arteries. So every animal, from the rabbit to the jackass, that they take out the thyroid gland had a greatly accelerated hardening of the arteries. And number two, their immune system declines precipitously, so they're very susceptible to illness. And the combination of a decreased immune system and increased hardening of the arteries causes heart disease. And there was a wonderful doctor, as I mentioned before, Dr. Barnes, who had a PhD in physiology of the thyroid, and after he taught endocrinology for 7 years, he became an MD. And heart attacks were first described in 1912. And he said in his old lecture tapes, which you can get through, there's a research foundation in his name. It's called brodabarnes.org, brodabarnes.org. They have lecture tapes from the 1970s. And he talked about how he realized his patients were not having any heart attacks by 1948. The heart attacks were epidemic in America, and our government started something called the Framingham Study to try to figure out what was causing the explosion of heart attacks during the 20th century. So they enrolled 5,000 supposedly healthy people in Framingham, Massachusetts, and they followed them for over 20 years before they published their data on what caused heart attacks. Well, Dr. Barnes, when he found out about that study, started his own study with his own nickel, no funding whatsoever, and he followed over 2,000 patients, basically, for 30 years. And I don't have the final, I didn't get copyright permission for the final numbers, but I do have the numbers that were published in his book in 1976.
What happened?
Well, he treated 1,500 patients plus. They had to be in the study for at least 2 years, so that's two treatment years. And some of the patients were in the study for over 20 years. He should have had 74 heart attacks, according to the... he should have had 72 heart attacks, according to the Framingham study, and different ages and risk factors,
right,
because they knew
right.
high cholesterol and high blood pressure, and males, for instance, had a higher incidence of heart attacks, or at least they used to. So he should have had 72 heart attacks in his group of over 1,500 patients, and he had four. So he decreased the risk of heart attacks by over 90%, just by using desiccated thyroid.
Interesting. And we're going to get into that, too. You're going to explain what that is. When someone dies, Mark, of old age, you know, we hear that. They died of old age. What do they die of?
Well, some sort of organ failure, typically. Congestive heart failure, pneumonia was a common cause of death, kidney failure. There are all sorts of chronic diseases that they can die of old age with.
I mean, in theory, if the heart doesn't stop beating, if the arteries stay clear, if your organs stay healthy, could you theoretically just keep living and living and living?
Well,
if nothing breaks down.
Well, there's our genetics. We have to reproduce cells because every cell has its own lifespan. And, for instance, the nerves typically are replaced every 8 months. And the liver, for instance, is mostly fat, and all the cells in the liver are replaced every 8 weeks. So every time we recycle our cells by producing more cells, our genetics only allow us to survive so many reproductions, at least according to the science. And so maybe we can live 120 or 140 years, but eventually we're going to die no matter how healthy we are. Because our genetics are programmed that we can't live forever.
Your skin will fall off your body.
Well, you know, one of the main hallmarks of low thyroid is your temperature goes down because the thyroid controls the metabolism. And Dr. Barnes, once again, did research on college students and Army recruits back in the 30s and early 40s and published a report called Basal Temperature versus Basal Metabolism. And he found out that the basal temperature test was more accurate than the basal metabolism test and published an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1942 to that effect.
You're going to help us on that later when we get into it, because I went and got a thermometer based on your book. And as you know, the mercury thermometers are not available anymore.
Right.
And you don't like the digital ones for this.
No, there's some thermometers called Gerotherm, G-E-R.
I that's what I picked up.
Right.
It's what is it, an alcohol-based or something
that? Yes, and they're relatively accurate.
Here's the thing with that. The minute you take it out from underneath your arm, the temperature starts going down again, you know, because it doesn't lock in. And I wanted to talk to you about that later on, because you got to look at it really fast, and it's critical, because if you're off by, you know, 0.6, That's a big difference with this, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The reason I brought up basal temperature, though, you asked about old age and dying, and one doctor emailed me after he read my book and found out how important the basal temperature was. He was taught in his training program, the older, the colder. So that's supposed to be normal aging. But it's not so normal. It's because when you accumulate all these toxins, and we all are full of toxins these days.
More than we need.
Yes, there's so many interfere with thyroid. And not only that, it's the people who used to die of infections, and over half the population used to die of infections. Those were the low thyroid. So for thousands of years, the low thyroid people would die at a relatively early age. 1 day, 3 days, 1 month, 3 months, 1 year, 3 years, teens, 20s, 30s, 40s. look in the very old cemeteries, and there are very few 50s and 60s. And the average lifespan in 1900 in the United States was age 47. And we went to 77 in just 100 years. And so for generations now, since antibiotics and anti-tuberculin drugs were introduced in 1945, we have generations who've survived the rigors of survival of the fittest. Artificially. We've propagated these low immune systems for decades and generations.
Do you see the thyroid as probably one of the most important organs of our body that we need to take care of almost immediately?
It's the number one. There is no doubt. It's the master of the whole body. Nothing works in the body, including all the other hormone-producing tissues if you're low thyroid.
This little thing controls all this.
It controls every cell in the body, the speed and efficiency at which each of our cells work.
Incredible. I mean, does it affect cholesterol and triglycerides and all those things?
You bet. When I was in med school in my 30s, we checked everybody's cholesterol because it was in vogue back then in the 1980s.
Sure.
And my cholesterol was 160. I had an excellent diet. My mom was a wonderful cook and into nutrition.
That's not bad, is it, 160?
No. Back then, that was normal. It was up to 220. We didn't check each other's triglycerides, but by the time I was feeling really sick and in New York City and studying, because I was 42 or 3 by then, and nobody had ever given me any thyroid yet, and I was poisoned with mercury thanks to all my mercury fillings in the root canal.
Yeah, and I had all those. Thank God I had a good dentist years ago who said, I'm taking all those out.
Yeah, well, mercury is
not my teeth, the fillings.
Yeah. And the silver fillings, which are 35% silver and 50% mercury, profoundly block thyroid function. So anyway, I was feeling quite lousy and went to the doctor again, where I was studying at the Bronx, and my cholesterol went from 160 to 250, and my triglycerides were 400 something.
Wow, that's high.
And thank goodness, about that same time, I got to see Dr. Sonkin and started on thyroid, and within a couple of years, my cholesterol was back down to 150. And when I was doing my research, Rhoda Barnes wrote a book called Solve the Riddle of Heart Attacks. And in that book, one of the chapters is called The Demise of the Cholesterol Theory. And he has autopsies and all sorts of studies to prove his point. And one of the points that he proves was done on autopsies in Graz, Austria. I can go off on this if you want on cholesterol now, or we can wait
until
later.
Yeah, we've got a few minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, one of the reasons that cholesterol was supposed to be so bad for us was during World War II, people in Austria and Germany and so on did not receive any animal fats. They were starving, basically, and heart attack went way down. The incidence of heart attacks decreased dramatically.
Uh-huh.
Well, Dr. Broda Barnes found out in the 1970s, I believe, that Graz, Austria, was an iodine-deficient area, mountainous area. That's where Governor Schwarzenegger's from. And Austria. Oh, what's the capital of Austria, where all the most famous hospitals are?
Vienna.
Vienna was the number one, one of the number one medical schools in the world. And they studied thyroid quite diligently from the 1800s on. And actually, even before that, the state of health in Graz, Austria, was horrible. And Maria Antoinette's mother, the queen, Maria Theresa, mandated that everybody who died in Graz, Austria, have an autopsy. Because even before the dawn of modern medicine, the doctors had started doing autopsies in the 1700s. And since that time, everybody who dies in Graz, Austria, has had an autopsy. And Dr. Barnes found out about that because he knew it was a hypothyroid area, and went over there for 18 summers and studied 70,000 consecutive autopsies, all the deaths between 1930 and 1970. And guess what he found during World War II?
What?
The rate of atherosclerosis went up 4 times. It quadrupled. So the rate of atherosclerosis did not decrease during the war. It actually went sky high. So why were the people not dying of heart attacks? It's because they were dying of tuberculosis. Your immune system suffered more during the war because of malnutrition and stress. And so they were all dying of TB. And the autopsy showed all those who died during the war of tuberculosis had the most severe hardening of the arteries in the coronary arteries. And after the war, when the rate of heart attacks went back up again, every single autopsy person who had died of a heart attack had tuberculosis in their lungs. So the whole reasoning of decreasing cholesterol was preventing heart attacks was false. And the autopsies showed that quite clearly and convincingly. And, for instance, the Japanese had lower heart attack rates because their rate of tuberculosis was what it was in America 100 years earlier. Right. And that study's in my book and Broda Barnes research as well.
That's dramatic. Mark, when we come back, let's talk about what affects the thyroid. What's out there? People are asking about fluoride and in environmental issues. We'll talk about all of that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.